to episode 18 of the SPOPA podcast. Here are your hosts, Michael and Joe.
Hi everyone, and welcome to episode 18 of the podcast. It's Joe with you as always, and Michael is with me too. Hiya.
Hiya, hi Joe, hi everyone. Hope you're all doing okay. If I sound a little bit strange, I'm suffering still from jet lag just about.
Just dropping it in that you've been to Florida.
Of course. We're pretty much not doing our holiday special because I've got some of the audio description actually from a couple of the attractions.
That's something we'll have to sort for a future podcast.
We will, because we've got an interview with Paul Clayton to put on as well. So there's some little tips for future of things we've got planned. And also parenting as well. We've been asked to do that, so...
We have. We're going to work on all of that. Yeah.
So on that one, you know, contact us, podcast@svopa.co.uk. Tell us what you want. Tell us what you want us to include in future episodes. So what have we got this time then, Jo?
We've got an interview with Kevin Carey, who is the head of the R&IB.
Yeah, we've got the full one this time. Obviously, we give you a slight taster on the CD. So you get the whole what he's doing now and everything afterwards.
We've also got a couple of news items, and we've got the events, as always, the Liverpool meetup and the weekend breaks.
And we've also got lesson three of Around the School in 10 lessons. So without further ado, should we move on to the news, do you think?
Yeah, let's do that.
Here are some news items.
Right, we've got some really happy news to start off with. Our own Ian Beverley, who was in the same year as Michael at school, got married to his fiancée Elaine on the 7th of September. So we would like, I'm sure we'd all like to wish them many happy years together and many congratulations, you two. Right, we've got some good news. We've got a provisional date for next year's reunion, and that is
Saturday, the 17th of May. It is cup final day, just to mention that, but obviously Liverpool or United are probably not going to do that well anyway, so that's not going to be a problem. Never in Everton or City.
If you let us know if it's a good date for you, we have had some feedback already on the group saying that people quite like that date, but, you know, obviously we want, if we can, get as good a turnout as we had this year. So let us know if you want us to negotiate with school or if that's okay with you.
Also, the school have advised us that they're now participating in a project to try and get the school set up with solar energy to obviously save them some money. But it's also being done as a business project for the students to sort of set up as an enterprise and to try and raise the profile and get this in place. So if you're interested, just go to www.solarschools.org.uk/St Vincent's and you can get more information on there.
And now here are some events. Why not come and join us at one or two or all of them?
Okay, so on the 19th of October we have our Liverpool meetup. We've already got a few people coming on that, and hopefully John Patterson, the principal of St Vincent's, will be joining you all for that. And Michael's going to give you the details of where to meet, what time it starts, and where it's going to be.
Right, yeah, it's we're going to start from 12 o'clock and basically end when the last person leaves. That's always a good way of doing it, especially after the Manchester one, because you don't have an idea how long something's going to last. And we started at 12 and there were people still there at 7:30-ish. So, you know, just make the most of the day. So it's being held at the Wetherspoons Pub, which is the Richard John Blackler, which is actually on Great Charlotte Street. So it's not that far from Lime Street. And looking at it, it's probably not that far from Central Station either. So we'll plan to meet up at Costa Coffee for those at Lime Street. From 11:30, 11:15, 11:45, something like that. If you are coming, drop us an email, podcast@svlpa.co.uk, or give me a call on 07930444656. I want to say as well, thanks to Rob and Paul, because it's actually them who've put this one together for us.
It is, yeah. Thanks, guys. And also, if you can't make it at 12 o'clock, don't feel that you can't go and join them. If you want to pop in for an hour or a couple of hours in the afternoon, then feel free to do that. It's not compulsory to start when everybody else does.
No, it is. It's a drop-in, isn't it, at the end of the day?
Yeah.
We'll be there. There's things going on. Yeah, we'll just be sat around having a meal, a chat. I don't know what else will happen. And just come. You know, give us a ring. If you come in, we can try and find you. If you come to the pub or whatever, you know, and just join us. Let's have some fun.
Why not email us at podcast@svupa.co.uk?
So now we've got the full-length interview with Kevin Carey, who is the chair of the RNIB.
I'm going to introduce Kevin Carey now, the chair from the RNIB. It's great to have him available to speak to us. So how are you doing, Kevin?
I'm really well, thanks.
And you're just sort of relaxing now, ready to go away tomorrow for a bit of time in the sun?
Yeah, I have about 10 days every year when I just completely wind down and become vacant because the other 355 of them I'm full on.
Well, I know when I've seen you, you've been running around and you've been pretty busy all the time. So, but it was quite interesting talking to you. I think it was last AGM, the one in 2012, and we were just talking about school and things. And you mentioned that you actually went to St. Vincent's when you were a youngster. So when did you roughly go?
Well, I went at 2 years and 5 months old, which was remarkably young for a child to go to boarding school. But my parents were told that if I didn't go then, I might not get a place later. And as my parents were strong Roman Catholics, they wanted to get me right in there. So in May 1954, 2 years and 5 months, I went to St. Vincent's.
I thought I was young at two and a half when I first went to school in Southport, the boarding school. So I suppose you won't have any early memories of your time there, but do you have any sort of just general memories of some of the things you did while you were there and sort of special memories and people?
Well, it's funny because, of course, as you're at boarding school, much more than half of your time when you're young, my first memory of anything is a memory of sitting on steps in St. Vincent. So, you know, the first thing that I can actually depict of myself happened there. And I was at primary school there until age 11, and I have to say that people today wouldn't recognize that kind of education. It was very, very disciplined. It was very, very strict. And actually, I don't think the nuns or the housemistresses knew anything about the word play. And by the time I was 11, I'd actually read most of the school library, which is, you know, probably why I got a bit learned later on. I suppose by today's standards you'd call it sort of even harsh, but at the time we didn't know any different, and that's how it was.
So how often did you get to go home, Kevin?
I went home at obviously Easter, summer and Christmas holidays, and we had in those days half terms that were just from Friday afternoon to the following Tuesday afternoon, so not very long. And, of course, because I was at boarding school, and when I went home, particularly for the summer holidays, it was a bit trying because I didn't know any children of my own age at home. So as I grew up, I spent huge amounts of time in my hometown of Todmorden walking alone on the Pennines, and later on when they invented transistor radios, walking on the Pennines with my transistor radio or sitting on summer evenings in the park with the transistor radio. You know, the transistor radio became a tremendous friend because I think it's fair to say I was a lonely child. So, you know, when I was at school, I kept counting the days till the holidays, but weirdly, once it got to the summer holidays, at least, I was counting the days till I got back to school. I liked Easter holidays and Christmas holidays. They were short and there was loads to do, but I found the summer holiday a bit of a trial.
Yeah.
I think I was similar as well, because like I said, I was at boarding school all my work sort of school life, and like I say, you look forward to going home, but you don't know many people at home. I know Jo was slightly different because she went later, and when she was 11, but it's just that much different, isn't it? You know, school becomes part of it, and all your friends are at school, really.
So how old were you when you left St. Vincent's?
Well, I left being in full-time education at St. Vincent's at age 11 for this reason. I was born in 1951, and I was part of that big spike in child blindness that occurred because of retinopathy of prematurity, which was blindness caused by children being given too much oxygen at birth. It only happened in countries that either had a national health service where you had access to free health, or in countries like North America where parents could afford to buy incubation for their children. And there was a window between about 1948 when people started using incubators to keep premature babies alive, and 1956 when they discovered that too much oxygen damaged people's eyes. And in fact, in some cases, too much oxygen also gave people mental impairment problems. And what's really very funny about that generation of children that I've been in was that 70% of them were below average IQ, and 30% of them were way above average IQ, and none were in the middle. And my problem, and some of my contemporaries, was that St. Vincent's as a special school could not give us the kind of secondary education that we needed. So I was sent in the daytime to the neighbouring boys' Roman Catholic Grammar School, the Cardinal Allen School, and lived in St. Vincent's in the evenings, so I was part of the St. Vincent's social life in the evenings and at weekends, but I was in an ordinary day school in the week. And when I was 16, I was fostered out so that I only went into St. Vincent to do my homework. I went to the grammar school in the daytime, and I stayed with foster parents in the evening. So my relationship with St. Vincent's didn't end till I was 18, when I went to university. But it was a kind of a gradual moving out from being there full-time until 11, and then finally just dipping in and out of there when I needed to by the time I was 18.
That's really interesting, because today we kind of view integration into mainstream education as a modern thing, don't we? You know, as a kind of very current thing, but actually you were doing it right back then almost, weren't you?
I was the second person from St. Vincent's to do it. There was a family of three brothers called the Sherlocks who, over a period of years, did it. Vince Sherlock did it before me. Chris, his brother, did it at the same time as me. And Thomas did it much later. And at the same time, the very bright girls were going to Broughton Hall School for Girls as integrated about the same time I was. And I mean, the reason for it was that they wouldn't let me go to Worcester College because that was full of Protestants, and you just weren't going to let sort of a good Catholic boy like me loose among the Protestants. So that was why it was done. But in fact, it proved to be immensely important in the history of education for blind kids in England, because right through secondary school, my now beloved organisation, the RNIB, actually opposed mainstreaming, because it said that it wasn't going to provide blind kids with the kind of education they needed. In fact, it may well not have been as academically as good as Worcester, but it taught you about what real life was like. The first day I went to Cardinal Allen at age 11, there was a pitched battle among the first years, the new boys, between Liverpool and Everton supporters. And as Liverpool won on that particular occasion, I started supporting Liverpool at age 11 and haven't stopped supporting them since.
So what have you done since leaving St. Vincent's? You said you went on to university. What did you do at university?
When I was 18, I went to Cambridge to study history, and I was also at the time president of the Cambridge Union. I edited Varsity. Then I got a scholarship to Harvard and ran the university radio station in Harvard. Then I joined the BBC for a couple of years as a journalist, mainly writing news for Radio 4. and I was involved in the Experimental Broadcasting Parliament. But back in 1975, when inflation was running at 25%, it's really hard to imagine today what inflation at 25% was like. The BBC got an 11% licence fee increase, so they had to fire 2,000 people, and it was last in, first out. I was one of the last 2,000 in. So I was out, and suddenly all my life design, which had been to get into the BBC and then get into politics, kind of disintegrated. And just about the same time, by coincidence, I lost my residual vision. I'd be able to see a bit through St. Vincent's. I'd been a Braille reader, but I'd enjoyed picture books and watching telly. And I could see a bit, a few metres ahead. And that all went at the same time as the BBC. And it took me about 9 months to sort myself out. And then I became a member of what is now Sight Savers International, but then the Royal Commonwealth Society for the Blind. And I ran its Caribbean operations for 3 years, and then I went to East Africa and West Africa. And ultimately in 87, I became its overseas director, and was its overseas director for, 5 years. And then I started writing the reports on the way out to countries instead of the way back. So I thought, well, I've taught it all I can, and it's taught me all it can. So I set up as a freelance consultant in computing and set up a not-for-profit called Humanity with a capital IT in the middle of it. And I still do that a bit now. That's kind of been my breadwinner since 1992. But at the same time, I've done some stacks of other stuff like, well, let's say I'm chairman of the RNIB, so I've been sitting on its committees for goodness knows how long. I've edited the British Journal of Visual Impairment for 6 years. I was on the board of the National Library for the Blind before it merged with RNIB. I was a parliamentary candidate for the SDP in 1987. I've directed plays in an amateur dramatic company. I was a music critic for 10 years. And I've got 3 published novels and a couple of books of poetry and some non-fiction as well. And I'm a lay minister in the Church of England. Is that enough?
It's safe to say that anybody listening, you know, there's no excuses there.
No, there certainly isn't. Well, you know, it's it proves that if you put your mind to it as well, whatever it is, you can achieve, you know, whatever it is you want within reason. There's not really any barriers to stop you, is there, nowadays?
Well, I think it's really quite important for me to say to people who feel that they're struggling a bit that, you know, I did design my career around journalism and politics, and it crashed only 2 years after I'd finished university. And I recovered and I went to Sight Savers. In a way, Sight Savers crashed because I was picked as junior bright person with the idea that ultimately I'd become the boss. But somebody in the hierarchy just didn't want me to be boss, so that got spiked. And then I started out as a freelance computer guy, and I made a go of that. And although people say that, you know, it's just terribly difficult to get published as a novelist, which it is, I kind of in the end got my first novel published, and I've had another 2 published since, and there's one in the works. And so if you focus, and focus is really what counts, then you can make a do. But if you make a list of the things you want to do and a list of the things you can do, you can see where they match and where there are gaps, and you've got to be really forensic about it. The world is not going to help you out, I promise. Unless you've got something to offer the world, it's not very hospitable offering anything back. You've got to make deals with the world. That means negotiating. And that means having quite a realistic sense of what's possible and what's not possible and sticking at it.
Mm. That's good advice, really, because it is a difficult place out there, isn't it? The world is not a nice place, really.
Well, for people who are congenitally blind, I think the world is a very cruel place. I mean, mostly blind children get a very miserable education, which is far too bunged up with learning stuff that is far too complicated and unnecessary. I mean, you know, I'm in favour of people learning to read contracted Braille, but I'm certainly not bothered if they don't write it. And in fact, if they only read uncontracted Braille and they're happy with that, I'm satisfied with it. And the kind of equipment blind kids have to do mathematics with is just out of the arc. And, you know, Noah probably used it for counting the animals and dreadful stuff. And all in all, blind kids' education is a miserable clutter instead of being enlightening and joyful and optimistic.
Yeah.
And it's just a struggle. And then when you go down to the real world, unless you've been brought up really well, you'll find that you just don't know very much about that big wide world out there, and it's really very tough to sort out and negotiate your way through it. And I'm very keen on blind children being taught a lot more about style and manners and how to dress and what to do with their hands and what to do with their heads and all that sort of stuff, and slightly less sort of serious academic stuff. And, you know, because you can be academically as bright as you like, but if you roll your head down instead of looking at the person talking to you, you're not going to get a job. So it's actually really important that we get the social side of it right. When I lost my sight completely and I thought I needed just a bit of help, I actually went to a film director friend and got videoed for a week. And what was really painful was him reviewing the video back and telling me all the things that I was doing wrong with my hands, with my head, and all sorts of stuff. And I had to be coached or coached myself into doing all the right things so that people weren't terribly put off by me as a blind person. So instead of concentrating on me as a blind person, after a time you hope they're going to concentrate on what you were saying. Because people are really fazed if you walk into a room for an interview and they haven't been warned in advance you're blind. By the time they've gone over the blindness, the interview's over. So, you know, you really have to do something about that side of it.
Mm. Yeah, that's good advice.
I know we've been talking quite a lot with, obviously, John Patterson, who's the currently running St. Vincent School as well. And some of the ideas I think he's involved with, and obviously continuing from what Steve Roberts did, is an absolute complete change to what we did. And I think it is more going towards what you're sort of saying as well. And it's getting children ready for work, for the real life, and for a future.
Yeah, I saw John last week, funnily enough, in Manchester. He and I lunched together, and he was sort of going over where he was and what he wanted to do with the small, medium enterprises and trying to get children to focus on work and lifestyle, and I think that's entirely the right way to do it. I mean, I don't think that special education accepting the national curriculum for the ideological reason that blind kids should be educated the same way as sighted kids, I don't think it's done blind kids any services at all. I actually think that there's such a lot that blind kids have to learn that isn't in the national curriculum that it just was a mistake to focus so much time on that. And if John Patterson can loose the shackles of regimented education, that would be also good, because we want children to be able to hold down jobs, because that's self-respect, that's money. And also, in the world that we live in, you know, you're not going to be able to form a good, long family relationship if you don't have some sort of economic base. I mean, there may be the occasional potential partner up there who doesn't mind if the other partner doesn't work and hasn't got any skills, but by and large, we expect family units now to have two earners, not one. And it's really important that blind people get that kind of leverage.
I mean, do you want to just share a little bit about your work for the RNIB? Because I know a lot of our listeners are hopefully RNIB members or involved in the RNIB, but there's going to be people who haven't really heard that much of the work. It'd be nice to just finish off with a little bit on that side of things, if that's okay.
Well, you know, just the big thing, that I'm chairman of the RNIB, but it's not like being the dictator of a small country where you walk into the office and say, today we are going to do this. I mean, you know, I'm the chairman of a board of 19 people, and the board interacts with the senior management team, and I have a very good personal relationship with Leslie Alexander, the chief executive. And we put together a corporate strategy, and then we construct a business plan around that, and then we construct budgets around that. And my job is to deliver the board to the management and deliver the management to the board and see that if there's any issues on the horizon, they get dealt with before they become a problem. And I'm at the top of the governance thing. You know, that means lots of committees, which is my favourite thing, but I like getting stuff done. And we have around about £120 million a year to get stuff done with, and that involves braille production and audiobook production and a special school for blind kids with additional disabilities and a campaigns unit that's got a very good deal for blind people over the conversion from DLA to PIP. We've got services that help people pick up more benefits. We've got rehabilitation employment services. It's a huge bunch of businesses rolled into something called the R&IB, and it's very complicated to run because it is so complicated. And sometimes people get fed up with us because we're slow and bureaucratic, but look at it. If you're running a biscuit factory, the only damn thing a biscuit factory does is make biscuits, right? Make different flavors of biscuits, but its core job is biscuits. R&IB doesn't have a core job like that. It has lots of different jobs for lots of different people, going from birth up to 100 and going from intensive education down to providing people with leisure services or advice or trying to change the mind of the government. It's an immense range of stuff, and it never stops. And in an environment where there's been local authority cuts in particular, but also national government cuts, you know, we've had to work hard to keep blind people where they are instead of dropping backwards, and more people want our services, and raising money is a lot more difficult every year because a lot of charities need to do it with demand on their services and people's income shrinking. So it's a whole big thing, and it takes me about 2.5 days a week to do it, and that's the time I'm in London. That's without the reading and the email sending and the thinking. And that actually means that, you know, it's kind of a big half-time job for me. One more thing I should say to people, and that is that, you know, if you're not members of R&IB, join. We actually need people to join us so that we can hear what they tell us that they want, because that is how we write our strategy. We need people to work with us at the regional level to campaign with their health authorities and local government to stop cuts. We need people who will obviously give us money. We need people who will volunteer to work with blind people at local level. We need people who are just general supporters and wish us well. So we need a whole vast range of people to all become part of what I hope we're turning into the R&IB family. I mean, we're a business, but we also hope that the people who are our members are family rather than being called clients or customers or beneficiary. I mean, I just think of all the people I work with who are blind and partially sighted as friends. I mean, they may not be close friends, but I want to treat all blind people that come into the orbit of R&IB as friends, and we would just love anybody who doesn't know enough about us to take a look at us. And, you know, if you don't like it, well, fair enough, but I think everybody will find something in R&IB that they will benefit from.
And I think as well, from, you know, people like myself and yourself who are congenitally blind, we may have had bad experiences years ago with R&IB or other associations, but like myself and others, look at it again. Don't just take the past and look at the future. And I mean, I've been a rep for the R&IB for a couple of years, and I hope to do more in the future as and when time allows. So, you know, do look at it again, anyone who's sort of turned the back a little bit.
Well, look, I had my fights with R&IB in the 60s and 70s, and now I'm at the top, so there you go.
Yep, thank you very much, Kevin.
You're very, very welcome, and if I can do something again for you, just let me know.
Thanks for joining us, Kevin, for the interview. It was really good to hear your full life story and what you're doing. And it shows what can be achieved if people want to. You know, I mean, that's the beauty of life, isn't it? It's, you can do what you want.
Yeah, it really does showcase that anything really is possible if you've got the determination.
It is, which I haven't.
No.
Right, well, there's still time to enter the competition, which we mentioned last month, which is name somewhere in the school where the soft play has been. I do appreciate some people who were at the school before the soft play was put in may not know, but I think you've been to the reunion, so there's a good chance you'll know. So email your answer in at podcast@svopa.co.uk. All entries need to be in by the 31st of October. And we're going to draw them at SVOPA Live in London now.
Why not follow us on Twitter at SVOPA? Now for our new section, Around the School in 10 Lessons.
Right, so I hope the class is all sitting comfortably, because it's now time to open your textbooks for Lesson 3 of Around the School in 10 Lessons.
Okay, so we're going to start down near the laundry, are we?
We are. We're at the top of the stairs, aren't we, where the gong used to be, where some of us...
Yes, we are.
Make our way down those concrete stairs.
Yeah.
Towards where the kitchen is.
Yep.
Which I think it was on the last podcast, just one little thing, because obviously the kitchen, people have gone in there a little bit, but not that much. But that has actually recently been all redone. The school really didn't have the sort of equipment it needed, and they were donated a load of stuff to update everything so it meets all the standards and everything now.
Ah, right, so that'll have been since the reunion, will
that it? That was actually only a few weeks ago. John was right. Telling me about that when we were having the interview a few weeks ago.
Oh, that's great.
So we spent about a week and a half installing kitchen stuff. So if you go down that corridor, I know there is a couple of rooms right at the bottom. Don't know what they're for. I know people who've been at school a long time probably have some memories. So you'll straight past the kitchen, past the turn into the laundry. So if you know what those rooms are ever used for, or you ever went in them for anything, you know, let us know.
Yeah, because I have no idea.
No.
So anybody who does, you know, contact us, yep. podcast@svopa.co.uk.
Right, so should we turn down towards the laundry?
Yep.
See what can we remember. What do you remember on there?
I can remember the old DS room.
That was right at the bottom, wasn't it?
It was. That was right down at the bottom. And it was just quite a long room, if I remember rightly, with kind of workstations along each side where you could prepare food. And then there was a table that we used to sit round if we were doing group activities. But that was only in my first year, so that was 1983. To 84, and then after that I think it was the new DS room, which was much better, but we'll do that in another lesson.
We will. I don't remember it. I remember going in it once. I think it was that we'd gone down to look at the Christmas cakes or something the year above us had done, so it might be when we were in the juniors, but I don't remember it at all.
No, it didn't. I mean, it wasn't the best for lighting and things like that, I don't think. So the new one was much brighter and much airier. So, it was a good thing that they did the new one, really.
Which was a great one, which we will come across in a later lesson, anyway, won't we?
We will, yeah.
So, and can you remember what else was down on that part of the corridor? I've got two things I can remember.
Well, there was the laundry, of course, wasn't there?
Yeah, which always that proper laundry smell, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. And that's where you used to have to go there after swimming to take your towels, or after PE, you used to take your towels down
you
there.
You did,
to
I forgot about dried. That. Yeah.
Yeah, you did.
The school towels, which are them fluffy ones that didn't dry you as well, weren't they?
Yeah, that's it.
They were brown or green or something.
Yeah, and it was always, I remember when we had swimming on, the boys had swimming on a Wednesday night after prep and the girls were on a Thursday night. And I remember it was always a little bit spooky going down there to take your towels down to the laundry because it wasn't a very populated corridor. So it's always a bit like, get down there as fast as you can and then get back.
Yeah. Yeah, I can remember that. And you had the press as well when you used to press the
they did.
Serviettes. That's right. And everything.
Yeah, they did. And they did all the sheets and everything for us, didn't they? The bedding and everything. Yeah. Wow. So go on, what else do you remember from down there?
We had the fridges as well. There was a storage cupboard, which used to have a lot of the food and stuff into the school. And then there was a room which had a couple of fridges in, massive fridges you could walk into.
Right. I'd forgotten about that.
So I don't think there was anything else on there, but if there was, let us know. podcast@svopa.co.uk.
Yeah, because we don't know everything.
No. So, I tell you what, we'll go back up to them little stairs again and we'll head down the main corridor.
Yeah.
Which you've got the first door takes you into like the kitcheny area for the dining room, if you remember.
It does, yeah.
Which had a couple of the really deep sort of catering sinks in. And then there was the corridor which leads to the kitchen, which used to have a load of trolleys in it, didn't it?
It did, yeah. I
don't remember. I think there were one or two there this year, but I don't remember them being there.
Because if you're when you were a boarder at school, it was a trolley, and all the food for the evening meal that you had was brought up on a trolley.
It was. Yeah.
And like for Keller, because Keller was upstairs, the trolley would be brought to the bottom of the stairs and then you would go down, a couple of you would go downstairs and the food would be carried up to your group for serving.
Yeah, that was the same in like Rushton and that.
Yeah,
We had a stage where some of the boys used to have their dinner, their evening meal. Yeah, dinner is the right word for it, isn't it? We call it tea up north.
Yeah, we call it tea.
used to have it in the dining room as well.
All right.
And if I remember rightly, there's a room off there. You sort of go in past the sinks and there's a door directly opposite. I'm not sure if that was a staff dining room or there was something there. Again, I don't remember what it was, so let us know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, these are all questions that we need answers to.
Yeah. And so I think we've got the dining room next.
And there were two entrances to the dining room, weren't there?
There was, yeah. Technically three, I suppose, if you count the one from the room we've just been walking around.
Well, yeah. But there were two that we used as if we were queuing up to go in for lunch, for dinner, as we call it up north.
Yeah.
And if you remember when we were in the sort of mid to late 80s, they started serving cold meals as well as hot meals at lunchtime. And you could have a salad. It was absolutely awful, but that's another story. And if you were having a hot meal, you queued at one door for the dining room. And if you're having a cold meal, you would queue at the other door. And
didn't you used to get a coin at your break to hand in at one point?
Oh, I don't remember that, did you?
I was feeling you used to get something. So
right.
To sort of say what you had.
Right. I know you used to have to order your meals in advance, didn't you? Every Friday we used to sit and you'd go like cold, cold, hot, hot, or cold, 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 hot, whatever.
Did we as well before we had the cold and hot? Did we go through a time where we had a choice of two hot meals?
I don't remember that. That might have been before my time.
No, it would have been, if we did it, it was when you were there. But
I don't remember.
It might not have done, it might have just been cold and hot.
And I'll tell you what else, do you remember you might have been in the seniors by this point, but when you used to have to sit at set tables and you used to have a fifth year sat at your table, and but after that you could sit where you wanted.
No, I don't remember that.
Do you not remember that?
We had mixed ages on. We had different years on the table, which was good because you got to know some of the people who were in your class.
Yeah, but you went in and you sat, you stood behind your chair to say grace before you sat down.
Yeah.
Then you'd sit down and have your meal, and then you'd say grace after your meal as well, if you remember
that.
Yeah,
I remember that.
Because it always ended with, what was it, may the souls of the faithful are departed, rest in peace, amen. That was always the ending.
The food weren't that bad. No one ever died during it.
I'm surprised, though. It wasn't good.
I don't know if you were there. There was one day some secrets are coming out on this podcast, and we're not going to edit.
They are.
We're not going to edit this. But do you remember? No. Do you remember Mike and George Ferguson?
Yes, I do.
There was one day we had liver for dinner.
Oh.
And obviously, normally it never happened, and I don't know why. It's one day, liver and the black and the green cabbage. I'm sure it was them. It might have been someone else as well. And yeah, they went round and pretty much got rid of everybody's dinner into the pig bin. So they called that awful black dog what used to torment the children.
Mm.
You know, that Beauty, she was lovely. They called Beauty down, obviously, to let her have something. And she just turned the nose off and walked away.
I'm not surprised. Oh, you know, these... But yeah. Oh, that is funny. But after that, when you just used to queue at the door and you went in and you got your meal and then you went and sat where you wanted and you were on tables for four then, so you could sit with three of your mates or whatever. So it all sort of changed in the 80s.
Yeah.
So I'd love to know what it was like in that sort of way back. What was it like in the sort of 70s or 60s? Let us know. Was it different then? You know, was it a lot different?
And now, I mean, they've redone the ceiling, they've put a lower ceiling in, haven't they? So it's acoustically, yeah, it's a lot better.
Yeah.
And they now have got round tables and probably comfier chairs, I think.
Yeah, I think they are, because they were always rectangular tables, weren't they?
They were, yeah, sort of six. Yeah. I think it was six on the table, weren't they?
Yeah, they were until the late 80s, and then it was four. They just sat two on either side. I mean, there are some fond memories of the dining room, because we always had our Christmas dinner in there, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
Which was nice. And do you remember when we used to get Marks and Spencer's overflow?
No, I don't.
I don't really get it, but it was something, Marks and Spencer's overflow, and they used to send it into school for us, and on that day we'd get a treat. I can't remember what kind of things they were, but we would, you know, it'd be like, oh, there's a Marks and Spencer's overflow. I'm sure people remember it better than I do. So again, get in touch and let us know.
Yeah, I don't remember that at all. And how often, if you ever get a serviette, do you try folding it like we used to at school?
Oh, yeah, it had to be done precisely, and if you didn't do it, if you couldn't do it, you'd get told off.
Yeah, you used to fold it into triangles, didn't you? And then lift the strip across the bottom up a little bit, fold it over, turn it round, and then roll it up and then stand it on the middle of the table.
Oh, my God. Oh, dear. But going back a long way, we've been talking about this before we started recording, and the dining room was once upon a time the chapel. Did you say 1928?
We think it is. I was talking to someone today and they think it was 1928 when the chapel was opened where it is now. So if we did get corrected, because we were hoping to speak to someone who was actually there, but when we found the date, obviously, we're not likely going to find someone who remembers that.
No. We're kind of asking a lot, but if anybody knows, you know, if you've got maybe you've got relatives who were there before you went or something, or, you know, somebody who might remember it, or if you know more about the history of the school than we do, let us know, get in touch.
Yeah, because we'd love to get more history on here as well. So there we are. So pretty much I think the school bell's just gone.
Yep.
So because there's nothing else on that particular corridor we're going to do. In fact, yes, there is. Shall we do one more bit just before we're going to stop? Just before we get to the King's Wing and Queen's Wing, remember the map?
Yeah,
the tactile diagram of the school.
I do. And also, I don't know if this happened to you, but when we used to do art and we were doing clay, and we were all asked to create. It was quite funny, really, I suppose. But we were all asked to create a plate of food in clay. There was all sorts: cheese on toast, fish and chips, all sorts of things, all done in clay. And Mr. Byron, who was our art teacher then, he made a display of it, and it was put up on that same corridor, so that it was in keeping, I suppose, with the dining room. So it was put up near the dining room.
Right. Well, I think we've overstayed our time in the lesson, so we're going to close that off now, and we're going to move on to our events. Since recording the podcast, we have had an update on the situation on when the new chapel was built and opened. I just want to thank Kevin Kearns for providing us with the correct information. Really appreciate it. The chapel, where it is now, opened in 1910 with a cost of £3,000. So we are pretty much unlikely to find somebody who actually remembers it. So we'll go back to the podcast. Thank you.
And now, here are some events. Why not come and join us at one, or two, or all of them?
Right, our first event is at the Belmont Hotel in Llandudno, which I know you've heard us say lots of times, but there is still time for you to book if you want to. It's running from the 1st of November to the 4th of November, which is Friday to Monday, so it's not far off. Is it 3 weeks on Saturday?
It is, yeah.
Yeah. It's £35 per night, dinner, bed and breakfast. Under 16s, a half price. Under 2s, go free. We've already got about 22 people booked in and some interest as well, people planning to book in the next few days. So if you want to come along, you need to phone the hotel direct on 01492 877 770, quoting SVOPA.
And the next event, you'll have heard us talking about, which is the Peterborough one on the 7th to the 10th of March. Good weekend, I think. And I've got to mention my birthday. Come on. Prezzies, cards, you know.
Yeah, right.
That one is, we've got quite a few interests as well. There's a couple of people who've said they come and who've never been to one of our events before, so that should be good.
Yeah, that's great.
And that is £40 per person per night for a twin or a double, and it's £50 for the single. Again, we've got probably about 10 people who've already shown an interest, so that weekend is definitely going ahead. You need to book direct with the hotel on 01733 561 364, quote SVOPA. That is, as I said, from the 7th to the 10th of March next year. And looking ahead,
so at the end of 2014, we've kind of put feelers out about having an event in York, but that isn't set in stone. So what we'd like to ask you is, would you like an event in York or somewhere around there, or would you prefer that we used one of the accessible hotels again?
Like, you know, Windermere Manor, the Belmont again, or, you know, the Lauriston, something like that. You know, let us know what you want, and if you're more comfortable at a accessible hotel, or you're happy to go in one of the mainstream ones. And if you've been in a mainstream hotel as well, what you found really, really helpful, let us know, because at the end of the day, you know, it's your experience which guides us where we're going to stay.
Yeah, definitely. Which brings us on to the fact that although we all help each other out on the breaks, and we're always happy to help each other and everything, and obviously the specialist or accessible hotels like the Vision Hotels and the Royal Blind Society Hotels do have that element of extra help available. If you feel that you really need a lot of extra assistance, then it would be beneficial to bring a friend or a member of your family or something like that, just to make it more comfortable for yourselves.
It's true as well, because we're all here on holiday to enjoy ourselves, and, you know, so if you do need that, that is something you just need to have a think about before you book.
Yeah. But if you let us know if you prefer the specialist hotels, if you've been to one of our, you know, Clifden, or you've been to Lauriston, either yourself or with us as an association, let us know which you prefer. Or do you like it that we do a mix of both?
Right. Well, I think what we'll do now then, Joe, is should we wrap things up? And
I think we should.
Yeah. There we are at the end of episode 18. We hope to obviously see you at the upcoming events, especially at Liverpool and Llandudno. I want to say thank you to Kevin Carey for taking the time to chat to us.
Yeah, so all it remains for us to do now is to give you the all-important contact details. So you can find us on Facebook by searching SVOPA. We've got the group and the page. You can follow us on Twitter at SVOPA. We also have an Audioboo account, which is SVOPA. Michael's on Audioboo at Ike Allen. And I'm... No, you're not at Ike Allen, are you? You are just Ike
I'm
Allen.
I'm just Ike Allen.
And I'm on Audioboo, joe.fishwick, if you want to come and listen to our ramblings.
Which are always quite interesting. So if you want to contact me, it's 0161 287 1841. Or my mobile 07930444656. And if you want to use the old snail mail, it's 3 Consort Avenue, Royton, Oldham, OL25SE.
And not forgetting the all-important email address, podcast@svopa.co.uk.
So until next time, it's bye from me.
And bye from me.
Bye.
Bye.